Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening. And welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, a place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Sej Thompson, radio host of West Coast Live, a national radio variety show at WCL.org, and your moderator for this evening's program. Dr. Deborah Tannen is the university professor in the Department of Linguistics at Washington, D.C.'s Georgetown University. University professor is a special title denoting her very special achievements in her professional career. She studies the way people communicate with each other and is the author of many best-selling books, and her research includes that has resulted in You Just Don't Understand, Women and Men in Conversation, which was on the New York Times bestseller list for nearly 4 years. And out of this book, it came from some of the early work that she did with Robin Lakoff over at UC Berkeley in the linguistics department, and Deborah Tannen developed a special interest in the gender part of the equation, which is what she has been so effective writing about, but also in terms of relationships with mothers, with sisters, with brothers, with children, and the way we communicate. Also the nature of argument and what it is in our culture that allows some people to argue and have conversations dissolve without moving forward in any way, such as we're seeing in Washington, D.C. at the moment, for instance. And how this conversational style, whether it's between men and women, mothers and daughters, coworkers, lovers, siblings, can be destroyed by misinterpretation, and how we can communicate better. She's had fascinating experiences in her own research, doing studies, and in fact finding out through her own attempts at research that she's had to bring to practice some of the very elements that she herself has studied and worked on. Her many books include You Were Always Mom's Favorite, Sisters in Conversation Throughout Their Lives, and You're Wearing That, Understanding Mothers and Daughters in Conversation. That makes you look like a house. No, I only say that because I love you. She's also authored many scholarly books and articles, as well as plays, poems, short stories, personal essays, and we're delighted she's visiting with us here in San Francisco while in Northern California, spending this year as a fellow at the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University. Please welcome Dr. Deborah Tannen.
Thank you. Thank you, and thanks, Sej.
I know that you wrote a play in your early days. I mean, there's an exercise in dialogue. How did you come to write a play?
That is interesting. Emily Mann, who runs the Bacarta Theater in Princeton, and I was at Princeton that year, she got a little grant to get people to write for the theater that didn't normally write for the theater that she thought could. She thought, based on the dialogues that I put into my books, both You Just Don't Understand, and the book I had written before that, That's Not What I Meant, the other name of the book. She felt that the way I wrote the dialogue indicated that I would be able to write dialogue for theater. And she invited me to do that, and I did.
Are you an inveterate eavesdropper?
Oh, yes, I am, yes. It's funny, I was just reading about how people are so annoyed when they hear cell phone conversations because people are talking. To me, this is the most wonderful thing that I get to eavesdrop on conversations. Talk louder, talk louder.
So what do you notice when you're out and around? Do men and women communicate differently over a cell phone?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. The question I assumed you were going to ask me pretty right off was, since You Just Don't Understand was published in 1990 originally, isn't everything different now, like 20 years later, almost 25 years later?
No, but you can ask that question.
But now that I've asked that question, I'll answer it. The patterns seem to be pretty similar both between women and men, over different media, if you're texting, email, cell phones, the patterns seem to be fairly similar. So, you know, as an example, and when you say talk on cell phones, there's also the texting on cell phones. Girls and women tend, it seems, especially younger women, to write longer emails, longer text messages, have longer cell phone conversations, talk about more personal things, maybe have more self-revealing conversations. And that is also why sometimes they run into more issues and tensions. So, for example, the book you mentioned, the book whose title is You're Wearing That, which is about mothers and daughters. The way I actually happened to write that book, I was discussing with a journalist the previous book, which is called I Only Say This Because I Love You, about all family conversations. And the chapter everybody wanted to talk about was mothers and daughters, and a journalist kind of blurted out, but why do you have problems with mothers and daughters? We're both women. And I thought for a second, and I thought, yeah, it's because we're both women.
Yeah. So,
and so because you talk more, talk at greater length, talk more often, talk about more personal things, you have more opportunity to say the wrong thing and can be more hurt if you have said what comes off as the wrong thing.
And so you find this to be different from father-daughter and mother-son communication.
Yes, father-daughter, father-son, yeah, the other three. So it's not that there are no issues in any, there are issues in any relationship, and certainly any conversation can lead to frustration. But it seems that if there's a father or a brother involved, they tend to talk less often, at less greater length, about less personal things. So, for example, and this can be true when people are very close as well. In fact, I had a little essay in the Times a few years ago where people had found that anyone who has a sister in old age seems to be happier. And they were thinking maybe it's because they talk to their sisters about personal things. Well, I actually found in my own research on both people of all ages and sisters, not all sisters were talking about personal things. There were many sisters who told me they never talked about personal things. There was one very, very close sisters, and it was just so moving how they told me about their relationship. They actually lived together when they were old, and one of them said her sister would come by, that she lived with her, and she would knock on the door in the morning, and her sister would invite her to come into bed, and they'd sit together in bed and hold hands. And she said they never talked about problems. Hmm. When she was divorced, her sister was stunned. You know, why didn't she tell me? And she said, well, you have your life, and I have mine. I have to solve my own problems. But knowing she's there, and I think the frequency of the conversations can be what make people at all ages happier if they have a sister, whereas if they have a brother, they may not talk as often.
How do you undertake your research? How do you find these sisters? Do you take out an ad? Is there emails, personal reference? Do you knock on doors randomly?
Yeah, it's a great question. My field is linguistics. It's not psychology, so I don't have random samples, and I don't have statistically significant percentages. I observe. I listen to the stories that people tell me. I record conversations that I happen to take part in and that people give me permission to record. I teach at Georgetown University in Washington, and my students go out and record conversations that they take part in, which they transcribe and analyze. And I have a class I teach called Cross-Cultural Communication, which is rather large. And every week, everybody has to bring some conversation in that they were part of or that they observed, and they analyze it. And,
do you find that you're...
So that will also be sources. In my last two books, The Sisters and the Mothers and Daughters, I did actually go out and interview people. And people told me about other people that they thought I should talk to. And sometimes, in some cases, I talked to 3, 4, 5 sisters from the same family, either together or separately.
Do you find that your students would change their own behavior based on how they were consciously observing others?
I think we all change our behavior once we know what the parameters are that can be affecting conversation. So, to that extent, yes.
I realize that tonight we might you might be having some sort of meta thoughts as we're going on, because you wrote a very interesting piece about the presidential debates and the role of moderators and, you know, whether the male interrupter was seen in the same way as the female interrupters in the evening and the role of the moderator in such a conversation. I thought, okay, I'm going to be moderating this conversation. When I try to interrupt, will it be perceived as rude? Will it be perceived as, or do I, as you pointed out, one of the women moderators said, well, people may be upset with me if I do this, like trying to put the blame onto somebody else. I mean, it was a very interesting way that you parsed the entire debate, aside from what was going on between the politicians.
Interruption is a topic I've written about a lot. And in fact, it was a colleague of mine who had emailed me and said, everyone's saying so much about interruptions in the debates, I think you should weigh in, and realize that was what inspired me to do it. So let me say something about interruptions that is important maybe for all kinds of conversations. I actually started out, my first research, my first book, was not actually about gender, but about New York compared to California conversational style. Now, I have to ask, how many people here grew up in New York City? A few people. Okay, so that was based on, and I raised my own hand here, okay. I grew up in Brooklyn. And my first, the first study that I did was of a conversation that was made up of speakers, of which I was one. Three of us were from Brooklyn, were actually Brooklyn and Bronx, from New York City. Two were from California, and one was British. And I had started out intending to study each individual's conversational style, what it was about the way they were speaking that made up that style, and how it affected the whole conversation. It turned out that I could only study the conversational style of the three New Yorkers because it was very difficult for the others to get the floor. And one of the reasons was just this tiny, tiny difference in timing. So we all have a sense that when people speak, right, one person speaks, the other speaks, you have to have some way of deciding when the other person's done and it's your turn to begin. And one way that we judge is pausing, right? Have they stopped long enough that we get the feeling they're not going to say anymore? I'm not going to let you interrupt me, so don't worry. Don't hold your breath either, or you'll turn blue.
It's just like taking a breath can be interpreted as an interruption, right? Or as a pause to interrupt.
Well, it can be a good way to show you want to interrupt, but then the other person gets to decide whether to give you the floor, which I'm not going to do just yet. So. Okay, so anytime two people speak or a group of people speak and they have a slightly different sense of how long a pause is normal, so it doesn't matter what the length is, the relative length is what matters. So if one person is waiting for this much pause and the other one is waiting for this much pause, this much pause comes first, and that person will start thinking, uh-oh, they have nothing to say. If I don't fill this uncomfortable silence, the conversation's going to run down, and you want to be a good person, and you want to be a good participant in the conversation, so you fill that pause.
It's interesting
and
that...
And it keeps... No, this is really important...
Is this the Brooklyn versus California thing here?
Yes.
Because it's also very different from the Navajo.
Yes, yes, thank you, and I'll get to that. So what's really crucial here, one of the things I learned when I started going out with these books and talking on television is if on a TV interview you're asked a question, you can't build up to your point. The point has to be in your first three words because otherwise you'll get cut off. But one of the wonderful things about radio is you can actually tell a whole story, so I'm going to have to finish this story. Thank you so much. So what's crucial here is you end up with one person feeling interrupted with the other one not having intended to interrupt. And that's what's the universal and really, I think, a theme that ran through every book that I've written since and everything that I do. It's the misinterpretation of good intentions as bad intentions that I think is so painful in conversations, and that's what it was that I felt in the book You Just Didn't Understand that so many people reacted to, and that I think was so crucial, that there's a feeling, here's the person I'm married to, if anyone understands me, you should. And then you get accused of negative intentions when you know your intentions were good. So talking along even, So, you know, not, let's say there's no pause at all. You're talking and I talk along as a way of encouraging you and showing how I'm really interested. Yeah, I know, the same thing happened to me. For many people, as soon as someone starts to talk, that means you're interrupting and I'm going to stop and blame you for interrupting me.
Where does the meta message come in?
The meta message is how you mean what you say. So, thank you for bringing that up. So the meta message of talking along could be, I'm really interested in what you're saying. I want to encourage you. But if you do it with someone who thinks only one voice should go at a time, that person stops and thinks you interrupted them. And so you end up with mutual accusations. One person is thinking, you never give me a chance to talk. The other one is thinking, you're making me do all the work here. And I'll just end on the interruption thing with this, because you mentioned Navajos, how it's all relative. So I'm, as you know now, from Brooklyn, and I had a colleague from Detroit. And I always had to be careful not to, in fact, I would have to count to seven after I thought he was done to make sure that he really was done so that I didn't interrupt him. His wife, he was also a linguist, his wife was Chinese from Hawaii. And she used to accuse him, you ask me a question, and then before you give me a chance to answer, you ask me another question. They did research among Athabascan Indians, because you mentioned Navajo, and that's also Athabascan. And there she would be the person interrupting, because apparently in Athabascan culture, you leave very long pauses. In fact, I'm told that it's not unusual if you ask a question, you might get the answer the next day. People don't feel they have to answer the question.
And it's a technique that is makes some people, particularly if you're from Brooklyn, really uncomfortable, because you ask somebody a question and then out of respect, you have to wait until the other person answers. And if we aren't talking when we're sitting side by side, you know, does it mean we don't have anything to say? Can we sit peacefully with one another until the conversation continues? I mean, it's a very interesting cultural difference. So, I have a question. And an interesting thing, in my radio show, which I've been doing for many, many years, I've discovered there's a difference here tonight. I have a handheld microphone where I interview people. And so I ask my question, and then I'd turn it to Deborah, and then I would bring it back, and I would do this. And it began as a way to get good audio fidelity of the question of the speaker. And one of the things I discover is that it actually allowed me to interrupt in a certain kind of way and make for kind of shorter answers, which worked on the radio. I could get more of my questions in. And yet, when we each have our own microphone here, I find that it's changing the dynamic, which I find very interesting. The story I was going to tell is about Jonathan Miller, the British physician and stage director, and he was directing once a production of Long Day's Journey Into Night. And he was looking at the patterns of speech in the play and finding that, in fact, when people are answering a question, it's not the question that's sort of immediately in front of the answer. But in fact, the person who wants to give the answer is waiting from a question about two or three sentences before. But, you know, and finally they get their answer in. And so he directed the play in an interesting way where he had people start talking over one another, as in real life, rather than waiting for question, answer, statement, discussion, and so forth. That's a characteristic of human speech. We hear something and we want to go, but.
It is. But I think what's so troubling in terms of human relationships is that we have such different senses of what's appropriate, what's polite, what's the right amount of overlapping talk as an example, pause as another example, how direct or indirect to be as another example, what topics are appropriate to talk about as another example, or with new media, I mean, everything is evolving. Is it rude or polite to a text when you're in front of somebody? Is it rude or polite to make somebody wait for an answer to a text because you can't answer because you're talking to somebody? Very different ideas about what's rude and what's polite. And even now I'll answer the question, you make a comment about what you said way back. Some people will say, you know, we're so close, we have such a good relationship, we can just sit for hours and not talk. And for other people, the relationship is so tense. We were sitting there and we didn't even talk. Or we're so close, we have such good rapport, we can be together for hours and never run out of anything to say. So all these different explanations that we take to be self-evident about the value of talk, the value of silence, the meaning of talk, the meaning of silence.
Do you find, when you refer to texts and so forth, you equate that with verbal communication? Is that different than from letters in your linguistic experience? Is text more analogous to, you know, speech as it ratchets back and forth between people? And do you find that there's an age difference, not just a gender difference?
Yes. Right. Yeah, texting, email, Facebook, these are all written conversation. And it's very interesting. In fact, I had, for one period in my academic life, if you ask people what I did, I was most known for comparing speaking and writing. And this is really fascinating because it's writing, but it's conversation. And yeah, so whereas in the past, a lot of my research was on gender and it was on cultural differences, not just East, West, California, New York, but also Greece compared to the United States. With the new media, I think the generational differences are probably the most striking. Our sense of what, you know, as I said, for example, that older people will think how terribly rude to be in a conversation with someone and to be texting someone else, and how terribly rude. I call my kids on the phone and they don't call me back and they don't listen. They don't even listen to the voicemail, and the kids are thinking it is terribly rude to call somebody on the telephone. If you really need to talk on the telephone, which you shouldn't, but if you really need to talk on the telephone, you text and you ask what's a good time to call you on the phone. And how rude to make somebody wait for a long time when it just takes a few minutes to answer a text. So yeah, we have very different ideas about this.
Certainly I've found with my son that he will prefer to text me and I will prefer to talk with him on the phone.
That's right.
Because I feel, in my experience, I can convey more information back and forth, and there's less ambiguity than in the text. So, for instance, I texted him back the other day, okay, to something, and what we expected to happen didn't happen. He said, well, I didn't know what you were saying okay to. And I thought,
well
if we'd been
on the
phone you know, it would have happened. One of your influential books was on arguments and the role, and I was very interested that you found in your own negotiations when you were going in to do studies, field studies and businesses and so forth, that if you had kind of a handshake agreement with somebody to go in, you were able to undertake your study. If the lawyers got involved, nothing happened except argument.
Yes. Yeah, that's a reference to a book I wrote called Talking from 9 to 5, which is about the workplace. So after the book You Just Don't Understand was published, I was contacted by a number of large corporations, and they said, we hire women, they're just as qualified as the men, and then 5 years down the line, the men have been promoted and the women are stuck, or they've left. Could it be something about ways of talking? And I said, I didn't know, I really hadn't done that much work in the workplace, but I would like to, let's work together and find out. In several corporations, they said, great, we're going to do it. We'll have our lawyers draw up a contract. None of the ones where a lawyer was drawing up a contract did it work out, because they had a lawyer who tried to foresee every terrible thing I would do to them and cut it off at the pass. And then I had to hire a lawyer who tried to think every terrible thing they would do to me. So and there's one I remember where their lawyer was demanding veto power over my entire book. So I could spend 3 years, write a book, and they would say, no, you can't publish it. My lawyer was demanding that I have that I be able to use the data that I had gotten from them in any way I wanted for the rest of my life. Obviously, neither of us could do that. I didn't want that. I told the people I was working with, I will not use anything that I had taped. What I did was have people wear tape recorders for a week, record everything that they said, had that transcribed, I shadowed them, I interviewed them. And I told them, I just gave them my word, anything I was going to use, I would show them, make sure it was okay. If they didn't want me to use it, I wouldn't, and I was good as my word. So, yeah, it's and I think it's symbolic of trust in general. that.
Do you find that it mattered whether the lawyer was a man or a woman?
No.
No. It was just that they
were training as lawyers. So yeah, but that book, The Argument Culture, is about our public discourse and how we turn everything into a fight.
Do you see anything going on in the news today that suggests? Right. There are some interesting questions here from the audience here. Have you done any research on the changes in communication throughout a long-term relationship, i.e. 30 years? And if so, what are your conclusions? Or can you speak personally? I don't know.
Well, I can kind of speak personally. I've been married 25 years. But I will actually quote, I will use as examples my parents because they are no longer alive. But when my mother died, my parents had been married 71 years. And when I wrote...
71 years?
71, yes.
Child brides.
Not really, they lived a very long time. And When You Just Don't Understand was published, so at that point they'd been married, I don't know, 50, 60 years. My mother said, you should give me half the royalties from that book. I said, why? She said, all the examples are of me. And I said, well, actually about four of them are, and I told them which ones, you know, she knew which ones were. But I say it to say after 50, 60, 70 years of marriage, sometimes the same frustrations do arise. And I don't know, I can give you an example from my parents to how this, even though after all those years. So one of the things I point out there is for women, often troubles talk or telling what's going on in your life, especially if it's something troubling, is a way that you create closeness and intimacy. So you assume you're going to be telling the people you're close to what you're worried about. And for many men, there might be a feeling that, maybe you have a problem at work, but you may not want to talk about it at home because, first of all, leave it at work. If you're aggravated at work, why tell about it and be aggravated at home, too? But also, there isn't that sense that you should tell about it in order to create intimacy. So one time, my father was kind of holding his arm funny, and my mother asked what was wrong, and he said, oh, my arm's hurting. And she said, how long has it been hurting you? And he said, only a couple weeks. And she was so offended, and she felt kind of like, what am I, chopped liver? You know, you don't tell me what's going on. So I asked my father, it's the way I do research, right? So I asked my father, why didn't you tell her? And he said, well, I guess I always was trained to be protective of women. Now, does that make sense to any of you? It didn't to me. I couldn't see how protectiveness played a role here. So I asked him to explain, and he said, well, if I tell her, she's going to worry. So it's protective not to tell her. Maybe it'll go away. And anyway, he said, if I tell her, I'm going to be coming up in the elevator in our building, and some woman that I've never seen before in my life is going to say to me, Eli, how's your arm? Because she's going to talk to her friends about what's going on, and not only her problems, but his problems.
So why do you think women feel safer in that kind of exchange of information, personal information, than I would say most men do of the exchange of that kind of personal information? Is it a safety thing?
I'm fascinated that you ask that way. You can certainly look at it as a safety thing, and it's true that if you talk about a problem, you're making yourself vulnerable. You could be seeing yourself as one down. And my father put it that way. He said, that isn't the face that I want to put out to the world as a man weakened by a painful arm. You know, I want to show my strength. I think every conversation we have is operating on two levels. There's the question, who's up, who's down, who's strong, who's weak, and there's the question, how close or distant are we? And it seems that many of the ways that women tend to use language, and nothing is universal, nothing is all women, all men, but the tendency seems to be that you focus more on the closeness-distance dimension, whereas for boys and men, the tendency seems to be to focus more on the up-down. And so the feeling that, yeah, you're vulnerable if you say what's wrong, you're not focusing on that. You're focusing more on the feeling that if I say something's bothering me and you say, oh, yeah, the same thing happened to me, then you feel more connected and you don't feel so quite alone in the world. So I think it's focus. And by the way, that was the difference that led me to the observation in the book You Just Don't Understand, which when I put it in that book, nobody talked about it. I had no idea what a big issue it was going to turn out to be. The question, why don't men like to stop and ask for directions? No, I didn't know there was a direction-asking crisis in the country, but that was the thing from that book that ended up getting all that attention. And by the way, people that know that it traces to that book have told me, how that has led to things in the culture like napkins, real men don't ask for directions, and jokes, you know, why does Moses wander in the desert for 40 years? or actually my favorite joke.
You think those comments are funny?
Maybe you won't like this one. Why does it take so many sperm to find just one egg? But my take on that was that same thing, that if you say to somebody, I'm lost and I need your help, you are putting yourself in a one-down position. So if you're attuned to that level, you're going to feel uncomfortable.
Now that sperm is equipped with map apps, I mean,
well, this is great.
Problem.
Yeah.
Here's a question here. I have a coworker who stopped talking to me and won't even make eye contact since I began enforcing a departmental policy. We are both female professionals. Any suggestions?
Wow. I would need to know more about and feel free to come and tell me more afterwards, but what the specifics are.
Isn't that a great question? Tell me more. I mean, it's also like the classic therapist question, to encourage somebody to speak. There must be tropes in our language that allow people to encourage people to keep talking, just as there are ones that shut down a conversation.
Well, again, I love that question because the same thing that will be encouraging to some people will be shutting down to someone else. So I think of a conversation, this goes back to my book, That's Not What I Meant. A woman came to me and said she could not believe it. She had a date with a guy. He asked her to lunch, and he talked about himself nonstop the entire time. And finally she said to him, why are you telling me all this? And he said, I want to get to know you. Which she thought was completely irrational. But often we think that we can encourage somebody else to talk by revealing ourselves. And if what we're trying to do isn't working, we will often try harder by doing more of it. So if he tells something personal, that will encourage her to tell something personal. And it wasn't working, so he tried harder and harder, then maybe what he said wasn't quite as irrational as it started out sounding.
It seems that generally, if you believe in the goodwill of individuals, that people do want to connect. They want to be able to communicate. So I've got two kind of different questions here that sort of get to this, and I wonder if you could speak to them in some combined way. One, what is the proper way to conduct deep conversation with your partner without being upset? Which is interesting because it seems to presume that deep conversation will lead to upset. And the other is, I call a friend on a cell phone, try to give information, but he hangs up before I have finished. Why does he not say goodbye?
Great questions. Well, let me do the cell phone first because, again, people have such different senses of the proper way to have a cell phone conversation. So I think for some people it's so clearly intrusive to be having a phone conversation that you know you just want to get the business done and be done with it. And so not saying goodbye, I think, is kind of a signal that the person is thinking of it that way. This is just the way we do our business. It's not for a chat. And I think to solve a problem like that, you might need to meta-communicate. That is, talk about it. And it's important to talk about it in a way that shows that you're not saying, I'm right, you're wrong, I'm good, you're bad. But rather, I know you don't mean it this way, but it comes across to me in a way that feels like whatever. And so it'd be helpful to me if you say goodbye or you make sure I'm done before you hang up. So that would be the cell phone conversation. How do you have a deep conversation with someone that you, a long-term relationship? This, again, is one of the things from You Just Didn't Understand that rang bells for people, I think. Often the very meaning of a deep conversation, I'm assuming it's about the relationship and about personal topics, has a different meta message, and for different individuals and often for women and men. So very typically, many women will feel the relationship is working so long as we can keep working on it and talking about it. And many men will feel the very opposite. It's not working if we have to keep working it over. So the very meaning of that conversation can be different. Plus, talking about the ins and outs of relationships is something that girls and women do from the time they're very, very young. So people that study kids will find the little kids sitting and talking, especially girls, will sit and talk, you know, and they sit like this, you know, they lean in and they face each other, you know, and they have that. So it's something that you're...
I've seen it.
And it's something that you're very comfortable with. Whereas for men, if you look at how boys are playing, you don't really see two little boys sitting like this, leaning in and having a conversation. They're more likely to be sitting like that, looking around the room or bopping up and down or, you know, play fighting. And so the very experience of sitting, looking at each other and talking is more comfortable for her than it is for him. And none of us like to do something that we don't feel really good at and we don't really know how to do. So many women find that they actually have better conversations if they bring it up when he doesn't have to sit and stare at you. Like maybe you're riding in the car or you're doing something and then you don't feel that. You might be more comfortable and less imposing. I'm seeing all the people exchange this kind of thing, and I want to say, how does this connect with your experience?
Well, I mean, the sitting the side by side in the car is classic. You know, certainly father and son, two men. You don't have to look at one another.
Yes.
You know, you've got this, you know, beautiful passing scenery and the music. You know, it's in a vehicle. It can actually create an atmosphere of intimacy.
Yes.
That you cannot
get
under other circumstances.
Yes. And it's an example of how we often don't realize that what we're reacting to is different for the people we're talking to. So I think, for example, of a student who reported, she would say to her boyfriend, you know, and have a talk, he would lie down on the floor, he'd close his eyes, and he'd put his arm over his eyes. And it would really upset her. To her, that meant he's going to sleep. And he'd say, no, I'm listening, you know, go ahead. And I have these video clips that I've shown, and some people have seen it, you know, on talks I've given or on TV shows I've been on, and remember it, where the little boys are always leaning in, and the little girls are always leaning in like that, and the little boys are looking around. So she saw these clips, we talked about it in class, and she realized that what he was saying made sense. What he said was, normally I look around the room and I can be distracted, so if I close my eyes, I'll concentrate better on what you're saying. So she accepted that and decided she was going to not take offense. And then the next time this happened, you know, I wanted to have a talk with you, he started to lie down, and he sat up, and he looked at her. And she said, this is, you know, great. How come, what's different? And he said, now that I understand why it means something to you, I'm going to try to do it. Now, I can't guarantee that will always happen, but it's much more likely for people to adapt if we understand the motivation of the other and respect it.
Let's see. There's some really interesting questions here, and they're legible also. This is great. I worked with people from different countries, yet the most misunderstandings I've had were from native English speakers from England. Have you found this? Is it because we assume an innate understanding amongst English speakers?
That's very interesting. It has been said the United States and Great Britain, a country divided by a common language. Right. Yeah, we think it's the same language, and it's used very differently. Indirectness is something I've written about quite a bit that can be different between men and women. It's also very different often across cultures, and it is something that often comes up with British compared to American, where British speakers find Americans too direct, too you know, kind of like a bull in a China shop. And Americans may find the Brits somewhat inscrutable because they don't tell you what they're, you know, what they're getting at. You're supposed to.
Or even more cutting in the nature of the remarks at times.
Well,
or
sarcasm
by what's not
is,
being said.
Sarcasm right. is a, yeah, right. honed right. to a fine point.
What is the role of humor in distancing in conversation and the ability of people to say something harsh if it's done in kind of a funny way?
Well, that's interesting. Okay. humor is something that varies hugely from one culture to the next. And it can be really a really good thing to do. I mean, sometimes if you can make a joke, you can tease, you can bring up something that really does bother you without offending. On the other hand, if you try to pass it off as a joke, but the other person knows you really mean it, then it can, you know, it can actually work the other way. And thinking, for example, of, so as you mentioned, I've written about mothers and daughters. There's a tremendous sensitivity in that relationship to criticism. The most common complaint I heard from adult women about their mothers was, she's critical, critical of me. The most common complaint I heard from mothers of adult daughters is, I can't open my mouth, she takes everything as criticism. And it's often two sides of the same coin, right? Because often the criticism is really like caring. And so you try to show your caring because, well, I guess from the point of view of the mother, here's the person you most want to help, make sure everything goes well for her. But that means sometimes seeing how she could improve, and seeing how someone could improve really does imply criticism, because if they weren't doing something wrong, they wouldn't need to improve. And often mothers will try to do it as a joke to be gentle, but it doesn't come across as a joke. It just really, you know, you can go fly off the handle. Yeah.
This is from a writer here who specifies that it's a he. The writer is a he. Do you think men talk to seek resolution and solution? Women seek to share and learn. Is one better than the other, or is it vive la différence?
Thank you for asking the question, especially part two, because it's a huge element of my whole approach to all this, is that I always feel there is no good way and bad way. That it's very important.
I just found that. Should I do this here?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. This is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we are talking with Dr. Deborah Tannen, author and university professor in the Department of Linguistics at Washington, D.C.'s Georgetown University. I'm Sedge Thompson, and your moderator for this evening's program. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio and also see video of the programs online at Fora TV.
Great.
We're back.
Okay, so now let me ask about, is it the case that men talk to find solutions and women talk to feel connection? Yes or no. I did, you just didn't understand, develop the buzzwords rapport talk and report talk, where I said that often women use language to create rapport, so you want to talk about things just feel connected. I sometimes use the phrase there for girls and women, talk is the glue that holds a relationship together. And I said report talk is sometimes more typical of men, where you might want to talk about impersonal things. I don't think it's that you're always trying to solve problems, but you might talk about impersonal things like information about the latest technology or the new laptop or your new cell phone or sports or politics or, you know, less personal topics. But I actually think that we both, all of us, always are trying to solve problems, and you might try to solve them by talking in a very general way, and then you tell yours, I tell mine, and we tell about, you know, how other people approach their problems, and you are getting around to figuring out a solution to your problem. And I think when we all talk, we're trying to create connections. So, you know, if you're having a great conversation about politics or about whose laptop is better, that's another way of creating connections. I think we're both doing it at the same time. And I would never say that a way of talking is better. There's no better way. If you share styles and you understand how the other person is using language, then it's going to work. Right. If you don't share it, it's not going to work.
So there are a few questions here about public discourse in our time, ranging from Bill Riley's way of introducing or shouting down, interrupting his guests, to the current sort of impasse in Washington, D.C., where language is used and misused for various positions. And I was thinking about a question I've asked both Jim Lehrer and Robert McNeil at different times. I said, I like it when you have your experts come on to talk, you know, from your different points of view. I have never once heard somebody on your show turn to somebody else on the other point of view and say, that's a really interesting idea. I'd never thought of it that way. I mean, what's going on? Is it entertainment? Is it, you know, shoutability? What's the discourse going on?
Yeah, my take on it is, we're now into an environment where everything is considered entertainment. There's tremendous competition for audience. There's a feeling that if you lose the audience, you're losing advertisers, you're losing money, and so you want to keep the interest. There's a feeling, and I think it's probably generally American, but maybe more widespread, kind of Western, a feeling that fights are fun to watch, that it's going to be lively if you get people fighting. I don't think it's true. I don't think audiences do appreciate it, but I think that's the feeling. And and it's easy anyway. I've got this 24-hour news cycle. You've got to fill the airwaves. And so I think for many of the producers, okay, well, let's get people with polar opposite views. The farther away, the better. Let them fight it out. And you don't have to think that much about how you're putting your show together. But it is cultural. I had a student from Japan who did her dissertation on Japanese news shows. And she found that they never had two guests. They had one or they had three or more. For us, it's quite typical to have two with polar opposite views. So I think it is, and I think it's extremely unfortunate because it turns everybody off. And then people turn off the TV, and they end up feeling that there's no solution. Whereas often, if you had people with more typical views, which tend to be more nuanced and more moderate, they can work out solutions.
And part of that is the sort of the convention in American journalism that there are two sides to an issue, and each side, ergo, has equal merit and deserves equal time. Whereas, say, in Britain, you will find opinionated newspapers, you will find opinionated newscasts. There will be people who will not take creative determinism, you know, as the same as an equivalency to evolution. It'll be, you know, but in this country, we can do those sorts of things.
Oh, and actually, Holocaust denial has been far more successful in this country than any other country, and it's partly because they have been able to masquerade as the other side in a debate. Deborah Lipstadt has written a book about that, and I've heard her talk about this. She was invited on at the time to a talk show where they said they wanted to have Holocaust deniers come on the show and debate her, and she refused. She said she didn't want her book to be a platform for the very lies that her book was intended to argue against, and they said, don't you think people have a right to hear the other side?
So that kind of false equivalency can exist.
Yes, and yeah, same thing with climate change, right, where it was almost impossible for any news article to not also quote the climate change deniers, because that gave balance. And you can hear journalists say that sometimes their editors won't even let them cover a topic if they can't find another side.
Yeah. How have you seen the field of linguistics change since you first started studying it? Probably as a kid you were studying it, you know, observing, listening. But in the sort of the formal academic world, has linguistics evolved in some way? Is it increasingly algorithmically driven, or does technology play an important role, or is it still observation?
Well, the field of linguistics, it's the study of language, and what I do might be called discourse analysis or sociolinguistics. is very different from people who study syntax or study phonology, sound systems. But I'd say very happily that more and more linguists are doing the kind of stuff that, you know, that I talk about, using actual studies of real language to find out how people use it in their everyday lives. And there's a lot more recent work on using the technology of recording, which is getting better and better, so that you can look at the very subtleties of voice quality and how that affects conversations. That's a very exciting new frontier in linguistics.
Where does body language fit into the study of linguistics?
You know, there are people who will tell you that 90% of the meaning that you get is from body language and facial expression. There's still a lot for us to study in the 10%, but I find that it is always an analog to what you find in speaking. So, for example, when I mentioned girls tend to lean in and I did the body language, that's just very analogous to talking about personal things. And so I think it's not completely different. It's analogous.
Recent studies have shown that multitasking, in fact, makes us less efficient in all of the tasks rather than focusing. There's a question here. It says, are women better at carrying on multiple conversations at the same time? And if yes, does it have anything to do with motherhood?
I think the ability to carry on multiple conversations is probably varies more by culture and by region than by gender. Certainly motherhood means you've got to pay attention to the kids and pay attention to other things and go back and forth. And yeah, I think multitasking is now typical of young people compared to older people. That's one of the things with the pervasiveness of new media. And you'll probably see your kids, young people, they'll be texting and they'll have the screen on and they'll be doing Facebook and they'll be trying to do their homework and, you know, do it all at the same time.
And what's interesting, though, is that there it creates an illusion that we're being more efficient while we're being less efficient. And it's this very curious kind of circular self-denial that's going on.
I think there is evidence that if you can put everything else aside and focus on one thing, you actually are more efficient.
You were talking about cultural differences. It was interesting to hear about Japanese television. And certainly there are cultural differences, you know, in the way an Italian family would communicate versus, you know, a Beverly Hills community family, perhaps. And you spent some time living as a young person in Greece. You must have noticed differences there. Is there a cultural variety in, say, resolving this question from the audience? How do family members make a fresh start in communication when there is so much history, baggage? What's the role of holding a grudge? You know, when do people let go? My son lived with a family in Italy, and he said, oh, they're so loud. And then he'd say, they would yell at one another over the most trivial things, and they would all be forgotten and gone.
Yeah.
You know, and there are other people who will just hold on, you know, to a sore, you know, like a sore tooth, you know, work it constantly. Something.
That's great. Yeah, I love that question about family because, again, my last three books are all about adult family relationships. What is wonderful and risky about conversations in families is that every conversation, everything you say, carries meaning, not just from this conversation, but every conversation you've had before. And in families, of course, you've had many conversations before. And that's why, you know, people have said to me, for example, about sisters, the most wonderful thing about my sister, you know, all she has to do is say one word and we burst out laughing. But then also, all she has to do is say one word and gets my goat. Or, again, the conversation between mothers and daughters. So I think, for example, sitting across the room from, across the table from my own mother, and she looked at me and she said, do you like your hair that long? And I burst out laughing, and she, you know, said, why? And I said, well, you know, I'm writing this book, and so many women tell me that their mothers are critical of their hair. And she said, I'm not criticizing. And then a little later in the visit, I said, so, Mom, what do you think of my hair? She said, I think it's a little too long. Now, how did I know that? I knew that because she always thought my hair was too long. I would get it cut before a visit. I'd get her cut the morning before I visited her, but she still thought it was too long. And by the way, she was probably right, and it probably is too long. And when I sign books, you know, women, people will come up to me and say, and your hair looks great the way it is. But then I once spoke at a Jewish community center in Washington, and a woman came up to me after and said, your hair is too long. But
did she also ask you for directions at the same time?
But to answer the question, that is the strength and the risk of family relationships and family conversations. And different families will handle it in different ways, and there are huge cultural differences here. So absolutely, cultural as well as individual differences, where you will scream and yell, and then your friends, and maybe the screaming and yelling is just teasing. And then there are others where you will be extremely understated, but people will know. Or as I've, you know, heard people say, my mother just has to look at me, not say anything, and I know she's critical of my hair or my clothes or my weight or how I raise my kids, you know, or whatever.
How did you prepare your husband for the first visit to your family?
He'll have to answer that question.
Okay. And so somebody had an interesting question here. Is there anything you and your husband don't talk about?
No.
No.
I will say, it's what people often ask me is, is it the case that you and your husband never have any misunderstandings? Because, right, you're both educated about it. And I often comment, well, we still have the frustrations, but we know, rather than blame each other, we'll, you know, be more likely to say later what, actually.
So that's good. So you're talking about the relationship.
You're giving me an opportunity, can I tell about it, something that is often an issue in families and how we've worked it out? Okay. I often will say that women tend to be indirect and men tend to be direct, and that can be true when it comes to getting your way, like, you know, the conversation that I've written about in the past. You know, couple's driving in the car, and she turns to him and says, you thirsty? Would you like to stop for a drink? And he's not, so he says no. And then later it turns out she's frustrated because she wanted to stop. And I've been asked, you know, why does she play games with me? Why doesn't she just tell me? And my comment would be that, well, probably when she said, are you thirsty? Would you like to stop for a drink? She didn't expect a yes-no answer. She probably expected something like, well, I don't know, how do you feel about it? And then she could say, well, I don't know, how do you feel about it? And then they can talk about how they both feel about it and come to a decision taking everybody's preferences into account. So that is a kind of indirectness, but it's just a different idea about how you go about making a decision, right? You start general, so everyone makes a comment, and then you work your way in. Or you start specific, and you assume, you trust the other person, if they're not happy with it, they'll tell you they're not happy. So it's true from that perspective that women do tend to be perhaps more likely to start indirect that way.
What if in...
But can I just do part two, but don't forget. There is a way that men are far more indirect than women, and that is apologies. Women are often... This hits home.
No, not necessarily. I've observed it, though.
Women are often very frustrated because the men that they're close to won't apologize. So, you know, for example, this woman, you know, they lived in the country, and she asked him to mail a letter. He said he would. And then the next day, there's her letter on the chair in the front seat of the car. And they both get in the car, and they look at the letter, and he says, oh, I forgot to mail your letter. And she's waiting. She's sure he's going to say, I'm sorry, and he doesn't. And they have an argument, but it's not about whether or not he mailed the letter. It's about whether or not he'll apologize, because it feels to her like he doesn't care that he let her down if he won't apologize. And I think from his point of view, yes, I committed a misdemeanor, but you want me to plead guilty to a felony. You know, it's not that big a deal. You know I didn't do it on purpose. You know I'm sorry. What is this trying to humiliate me by forcing me to apologize? So it
then, then there's the kind of apology, you know, which is sorry or sorry. Or, You know, and then there's the really heartfelt one. I mean, you can have a range of apologies.
It's true, it's true. And I'm sorry if anyone's feelings were hurt. That doesn't quite do it. But, okay, so I've forgotten that you started with a question about my husband. So this is something. There are many things where he and I are not, you know, quote, typical. He likes to stop and ask directions. I'm the one who says, no, no, I'll find it on the map. But he doesn't really like to apologize. And so we have come to an understanding. He will say to me, I apologize for everything. Which is really not an apology because it's not specific enough. You want to hear, I made a mistake. I realize it did you harm. I'm not going to do it again. But I'll accept that. And I think if we want...
I can see that it affects a man's, you know, sense of self-competence, you know, his view of the world, that if, you know, he has to make a mistake. There's nothing sort of, I suppose, more... for instance, in baseball, you know, if somebody makes an error on the field, 50,000 people in the stadium and a couple of million at home see it, and it's an error. But I guess I never hear them say, I'm sorry.
Yes, say, you know that.
They say, oh, you know, it's the game. We go out, we put it down on the field the best we can, and that's what we do. We go out, we do it every day, and now and again you have a hit, and now and again you don't, you know.
This is fascinating. A man who had always... coached boys' teams and coached girls for the first time told me he was stunned at first to see that the girls, if they made a mistake, would apologize right there on the court. Oh, I'm sorry. However, he found they really didn't feel that bad. If a boy did a mistake on the team, he would never apologize, but he felt rotten about it for days. That's
interesting,
isn't it?
Well, and to get back to the comment about the British English and American English, I mean, I heard a documentary on the BBC once, 30 minutes devoted to people saying sorry.
Yeah.
Well, sorry.
So sorry.
Fascinating. And whether they were or not, I don't know. Or it was a kind of a social lubricant. It allowed a very crowded, population to sort of. I mean, that's one of the things about politeness and some of these interjections, conjunctions that make for kind of a smoother running of a culture in some way.
Yes, and I think so much of what we say in conversation is because it's appropriate to say, other people say things like that, it makes us feel like the right sort of person, it feels like other people are the right sort of person, and it's not that it's all meant so literally. And this is the message, meta-message distinction that you asked me about earlier. The meta-message is, I think you're a good person. I want to have this, I want to be in relationship with you. And I think sometimes when we're frustrated, we focus on what the person said, but it's more the meta-message that has really gotten our goat.
In sum, do you find that men and women will eventually figure out how to get along and communicate?
Yes and no.
Yes and no?
Yes and no. The differences, it seems, seem to still be there. Again, I think of my students today, and they have the same kinds of frustrations. I think the young woman who said, she said, I am sick and tired of seeing relationship after relationship break up because the girl has sends long chatty texts and gets one word responses. You know, just like those conversations at home where, you know, you said, how was your day? And she tells you who she met and what that made her think and what that made her feel and what her friends said and what they're going through. And then how was your day? Okay. Did anything happen? Same old rat race. You know. Then, of course, you go out to dinner with another couple, and he's regaling the audience with something funny that happened because the place of talk in the relationship is different, right? Mm-hmm. Here you have to show you're a good person by having something to say in a group, and her feeling is it's at home when it's just the two of us that you want to have something to say. So those things, I think, are going on. But I also find, and I'm very encouraged by this, that people tell me that once they understand the motivation, they do adapt. And
So, how's this gone for us tonight? As far as the conversation, moderation, I'm not fishing for a compliment, or you, I mean, I think you're fantastic, but I'm just wondering in terms of the dynamic here.
I think we did pretty well considering it's East Coast, West Coast,
yeah.
And it's male, female.
Yeah. Well, there we are.
So there you go.
So our thanks to Dr. Deborah Tannen, best-selling author and university professor in the Department of Linguistics at Georgetown University. And we also want to thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Sedge Thompson, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, a place where you're in the know, is adjourned.